Ready? All right, we're going to get started again. It's 1:02 p.m. and Mr. Mann?
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to recall Don Steffen to address the sediment issue.
I'll just remind you, Mr. Steffen, that you're still under oath.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Mr. Mann.
Don, have you reviewed the Voight's concern number 4 that they'd filed late Friday afternoon relating to the sediment buildup at CCMC's Box Culvert in Coyote Creek near the shop?
Yes, I am.
Have you read their request for a special condition?
I have.
And you're aware that they're asking for the mine to determine the root cause of the sediment buildup?
I'm aware of that, yes.
Okay. And Don, is the mine already aware of the root cause of the sediment buildup?
We are.
And have you been monitoring the sediment buildup and its source for several years?
Yes, we have.
Okay. And Don, what is the root source of the buildup, in your opinion?
We believe the source of the sediment buildup at our box culvert, in those photos, is from upstream erosion transported by Coyote Creek. The source of this sediment is likely the result of significant erosion occurring in Voight's diversion channel, located half mile upstream from our box culvert.
Sure. And Don, I believe at least one of the Voight's witnesses suggested that, at least in part, that the sediment buildup shown in the photographs is a result from discharges from your sediment pond. And you've seen those photos. Is the discharge that they've depicted, is that from the sediment discharge in your pond?
No, it's not.
Okay. Don, can you take a look at what we've got marked as CCMC number 11? And then, well, maybe let's just look at all. I've also got another photograph, CCMC 12, CCMC 13, and CCMC 14. Are you familiar with each of those photographs?
Yes, I am.
And then I guess CCMC 11 is a little bit different. Can you explain that one for us? It's a side-by-side.
Yeah, that's a little different. That photo I had gotten from the informal conference, the photo that the Voights had used at the informal, they called it Exhibit B at that time. I think it's a photo that they actually presented here, too. I just don't know the exhibit number of theirs. And then the photo below, it's one that we took on September 19th.
So you took the bottom photograph?
Yes, it is. Okay. I did, September 19th.
Right. And then 12, 13, and 14, are those all photographs that you took?
Yes, I took all three of those.
And you've got dates on those photographs. Are those the dates that those photographs were taken?
Yes.
And are these photographs all photographs depicting Coyote Creek and the area around your discharge pond?
Yes, at the district and at that South Box Culvert, as referred to at times. That's west of our shop office complex.
Sure. I would offer exhibits CCMC 11 through 14 at this time.
Any objection? All right, CCMC 11, 12, 13, and 14 are received.
I guess maybe start with 11, Don, and looking at that exhibit, can you take us through the Voight's photograph the top one and explain why the sediment buildup is not consistent with discharge from your sedimentation pond?
Okay. If you just look at their photo, they present that photo, and one of the biggest things I notice is the amount of scoria and rocks in some of that sediment there. Before I get into that, I want to talk a little bit about our sedimentation pond also, pond 3101. Our sedimentation pond has been discharged 12 times since it was constructed in 2015. All discharges from this pond were tested for quality and all met effluent requirements of our discharge permit. The quality of water we discharged would have not have led to the sediment buildup in the photos. All our discharges are monitored. Okay. If you notice, the sediment in the photo has a lot of scoria and rocks in it also, which are not indicative of a pond discharge. All our pumps are fitted with suction lines drawing water from the surface of our sedimentation ponds and are well above the accumulation of sediment in the pond. Plus, our suction lines have screens or holes in our skimmers that will not allow the scoria chunks and rocks you see in those photos to pass. I'd also like you to look at very closely, if you look at that photo, as a matter of fact, can anybody look up at my screen on up there? One thing, everybody's been concentrating on this sediment here, around here, thinking it was from us to our discharge pipe. Look across here. I want you to note there's a good foot or more sediment sitting way across the stream, way over here. It's not from we have very little watershed above here, maybe a 50 by 100 area of watershed actually contributes to that spot. That sediment, there was absolutely no way our pumps could discharge and push sediment over there. It's just impossible with a 6-inch pump to create disaccumulation across there. Also, I would like to have everybody look at this next exhibit here. These rocks and stuff are just not indicative of discharge from our pump, but also look, that's our photo 19. Where's the other ones, Jess? Right here. Okay. This is exhibit number 12. I want you to take note of. This photo was taken upstream of our disturbance area at a location. I'm going to go to exhibit 13. This is that area where the sediment accumulation in the photo. Here's that big rock you can sometimes see in the photos. I took this picture right there, upstream of our activities, in this undisturbed stream. This is the Coyote Creek coming down to our box culvert here. And this is the photos you show a lot of this, but we've never taken pictures up here. I took a photo of the stream bed right here, and that is exhibit number 12. I just want you to note the amount of rock, scoria, and stuff in there that comes downstream into our box culvert area. The whole stream bed is full of rocks. You can tell they've been moving along the stream bed. Look at the grass out there. Exhibit 14 has been brushed over. We have no water discharge from up here, significant waters. This water does not get up there. The rocks don't go upstream. Those rocks are coming from upstream of the natural stream bed. A lot of them are getting deposited in the photos you see on exhibit number 11.
And Don, just before you move on, I think one of the witnesses, it might have been Mr. Bofto yesterday, identified in one of their photos, an accumulation of, a similar grouping of gravel and rock like this, and indicated that, that there was no way that could have come from erosion. I mean, what does this demonstrate?
I'll explain that. Actually, if you look at my photo, go back to exhibit 11, my bottom picture. I want you to take a look at this one too. You see an accumulation of pretty light sediment here on our concrete flake flex mats. Just before I get to that, I should say this photo that the Voids took, I can't remember the date. I don't know if they really give a positive date, maybe 17, I think it was, maybe 18. This is a photo that was taken here in September. This spring, we did replace all that concrete rick wrap with a different style system. I replaced all that with a concrete matting style system, just a better system that we had there. That's what's out there today. That was installed probably in April of 19, this spring. So this concrete matting has been used through the summer here. But if you just note, look at this accumulation here that showed up on September 19th. The creek rose from some rains that we got early the first week in September. It rose up, probably got about 2 feet of water in here. And when it receded, it left this accumulation of sediment on our concrete mats. And as Mr. Bolfo had explained here, this water coming down the creek, as the creek widens to make it through here, if you saw that picture before, the creek's real narrow, 15, 20 feet wide. When it hits this area, it slows way down, and it sits here in a little detention time here, allowing for a lot of that sediment to fall out. So this is just a natural spot for sediment to fall out, just like he explained. And it's very obvious from the photo then that this accumulation here is not from our mining operation. It's from upstream, not related to mining. We've had no discharges to create this. There was no pond discharges. There was not rain that did this. It was not significant enough to actually have water run off our property at all. So this is 100% accumulation from upstream that occurred from a rain in early September, and the photo was taken on the 19th. Just kind of confirms what Mr. Bolfco said about how sediment accumulates when it slows down in this area. And it's been doing that for years. It's just I've been watching accumulation, make sure it isn't significant. It's just been accumulated, and it has a natural, in this, most of the water actually has a natural stage of kind of cleaning itself on this area and continue to flow. But so I guess in summary, the discharge from pond 3101 is not the source of the sediment buildup in this photo.
Okay. And Don, do you want to just, did you want to look at exhibit 14 right now and just kind of explain what we're showing in that?
Yeah, I missed one exhibit. This picture was taken on September 25th. I just want to show a typical pond discharge, just to give you an idea of what, it's not this raging amount of water come flying out of there. It would ever blow that sediment across that stream 50 feet across there. It's a typical discharge. I just didn't want to give the reception, like, I don't know if you guys had actually saw a discharge of our pipes. So it's basically impossible to blow that sediment across 50 feet across the discharge like this.
And I mean, on this one, Don, even if your pumps from your sediment pond were capable of, putting out chunks of scoria or what, things like that, wouldn't that just drop out into here? I mean, it wouldn't go as shown in that exhibit number 11, would it?
If our ponds are capable of doing that?
Yeah.
No, I mean, they're just not capable of of transporting them rocks and scoria to that location. Sure.
Don, in your opinion, would the buildup that is shown in exhibit number 11 there, would that be consistent with deposits of sediment from erosion upstream?
Yes, it would.
Okay. And despite that understanding and your awareness of the origin of the buildup, you did evaluate other potential sources upon receiving the Voight's initial permit objection and request for an informal, correct?
Yes, we did.
And what were the other potential sources that you investigated?
I looked at two other potential sources of this sediment that could come from our mining operation. That second potential source, could be erosion at the discharge end of our pipe. That was shown in this photo. Obviously, that's an area that we watch. The discharge, I don't have a photo showing where it's at, exactly how it's discharging here, but we did have rock riprap at that location. Rock riprap and fabric liner below it. So it was functioning. We had a dissipator at the end of our pipe. We did not have significant erosion at this location that could contributed to this sediment, especially the sediment across the stream. The third source, potential source, could be from overland flow coming through our silt fences that we have prior to these rocks and across this area. We had proper silt fences in place. We have vegetated ditches in that location. The watershed that we disturbed contributing to this area is 7 acres. So we don't have a large contributing watershed related to our haul road contributing to this area. It's a total of 7 acres, all vegetated with silt fence and BMPs in place. So it too did not contribute to the sediment shown in that photos.
And Don, that brings up a good point. We did see some photographs yesterday of those silt fences and there, some sediment against those. You saw those photographs, correct?
Correct.
And the sediment fences that were shown in that picture, they were doing their job, correct?
Yeah, there was sediment collected behind them. It looked very fine in nature. There was no scoria and gravel in them, which I didn't expect. It doesn't flow across a ditch like that. And we don't have sources like that susceptible in that ditch anyway. But they were functioning properly.
Sure. So in your opinion, is the source of the sediment buildup from any mining operations?
It's not from our mining operation.
Okay. And you've just indicated earlier that the buildup is coming from, in your opinion, erosion from a diversion channel upstream. Is that something that you came up with just as a result of this hearing, or is that something that's been corroborated by anyone else?
There was others involved. In 2015, Houston Engineering conducted hydraulic impact analysis for the mine on the proposed haul road and box culvert on Kyle Creek. For this box culvert shown in the photos. During our site visit in preparation for this report, they identified this issue as well. This impact analysis was conducted at the request of Mercer County Water Resource District. Greg Thompson, a registered engineer with Houston Engineering, conducted the study, and the results were presented to the Mercer County Water District Board on May 14th, 2015.
And Don, that hydraulic impact analysis and report from Houston Engineering. You're familiar with that?
Yes, I am.
And can you take a look at CCMC Exhibit 15?
Got it, yep.
Okay, and what is that?
That's an email, a series of emails between me and Greg Thompson. The back page is an email I sent to Greg Thompson asking for the results, or I basically asked him for the presentation he made to the Mercer County Resource District Board. And in that same email, I asked him to summarize some of his concerns he had expressed with the diversion channel that he's presented to the board at that meeting. The second email is his response to me. It's on the first page. It included the presentation I requested, and he summarized his concerns with the diversion channel. On June 4, 2015, I forwarded this email along with this attachment to the North Dakota Public Service Commission so they were aware of this issue and the study he completed.
As a result of that analysis, what were some of the concerns that Mr. Thompson raised?
I'll just probably just going to read it here. I'm just going to take his email. You guys have it in front of you. You can read along with me. It's on the first page. I'll start with the first paragraph. When I was out there to review...
I just have to have an objection on the record. This is hearsay, and I think it's just unfair that they're essentially putting an expert report in without us having the ability to talk to this record or questions or comments.
I mean... Your Honor, this is a sort of an analysis report that was submitted previously to the PSC, would have been available. It was also presented at the informal conference. The VOITs had that, had access to it, could use it and do with it what they wish. I think it is appropriate to have it admitted as an exhibit.
This has been submitted to the PSC already, and it's part of their
on October 8th. Records. Well, there was... I guess it's a looser standard at the informal conference. I will admit that. But it was submitted and part of the record in that case. I guess this case or this docket in the informal. So it's in the docket right now, I guess.
Mr. Hsu, do you have a position on this exhibit?
Your Honor, traditionally the commission has been pretty flexible with that standard for allowing these type of documents in.
Okay. All right. Mr. Broughton, your objection's noted, but... I will admit MC 15.
Okay, I'll read from that email. When I was out there to review the proposed Hall Road site and visit with Casey Boyd about his historic flooding characteristics, I couldn't help but notice the erosion that has occurred in his bypass channel. As a water resource engineer, I felt obligated to bring up some concerns I had, especially because the head cutting had extended upstream to County Road 25 crossing with Cow Creek. Since the bypass channel replaced 4,500 feet of low flow channel with 750-foot bypass channel, creek slope through this area is steeper than it was originally. The channel slope is steeper than it can maintain with the given type of channel bed material. This is causing head cutting of the channel where the rolling rapids erode the creek bed. This will continue moving upstream until the channel flattens to a slope that won't erode the soil materials. There are a few items to consider in future regarding the head cutting. The erosion through this area will cause soil particles to be suspended in the flow, which will eventually deposit at some locations downstream. This deposition could occur near the proposed Hall Road culverts, but it also could remain suspended all the way to the Knife River. I suggest that the efforts of the erosion be monitored in the future so it doesn't reduce the capacity of the downstream channels or culverts. I expect the head cutting to continue migrating upstream, which could introduce problems with the foundation's upstream structure, such as a bridge along County 25. Head cutting should be addressed if any improvements are made to any structures upstream of the bypass channel. I am unsure of the fishing mitigation patterns through Cuyo Creek, but since the creek drains to the Knife River and Missouri Rivers, I'd imagine that it could be used for spawning habitat. Oftentimes, abrupt vertical changes in river profiles prevent fish from further upstream mitigation. However, properly designed rock drop structures are often used to maintain channel grade while continuing to allow fish migration. I also suggested fish migration should be considered with the current condition of the stream and with any future modifications.
Okay, Don, I think it's important in order to be able to give some context to those concerns that you've just addressed from Mr. Thompson and what we're talking about. With your opinion, I think it'd be helpful if we can sort of show the areas in question, both the upstream where we think the erosion is coming from, and the box culvert and sort of in historical time walk us through that. Can you look at what we've marked as CCMC Exhibit 16? Do you have that?
I have it.
And is that a series of, is it Google images that you prepared?
It's a series of Google images plus images that we generate at the mine.
Right. And you've taken those, you've dated the, historically, the sort of the progression of those images?
Yes, it's dated at the top of each image.
Your Honor, I'd offer CCMC Exhibit 16.
All right, CCMC 16 is received.
Don, just starting initially, okay, with August of 2009, excuse me, just sort of walk us through, you know, the area, the channel, what we were looking at that time, and sort of progress through the years and what necessitated the diversion channel and then ultimately caused the erosion. Can you do that for us?
I can here. This one, like you said, was August of 2009, based off of Google image dates. I'm assuming it's real close. This shows the center line of the creek as it flows around this area here. The Voigt farmstead is right here. Their house is actually located right here. I did, based on topography, base flow surface, that's probably about 1904 at this location. There is a bridge crossing here. I think I can do this a little bit more here. The county road was going this way. The Voigt's access to their house is this way, but the county road came around, and there was a bridge crossing at this location. Based on that time frame, my best estimate, the base flow was around 1910 at that time of the creek. So this is kind of, yeah, snapshot in time, August 2009 of the farmstead, and this is that South Hayfield that we've been talking a lot about, too, South Hayfield's in this area. Okay, I'm going to move to June 2010. Lots of stuff's changed. Sometime between August of 2009 and June of 2010, there was a major landslide affecting Kyle Creek near the Voigt farmstead. You can see it here. It basically plugged the creek at this location. Some of the water did still keep flowing. It knocked it, and then obviously the water flowed someplace. I don't know when it happened, but a lot of it probably flowed through the Voigt farmstead. But at this time, water was still flowing in this direction, but at an extremely high elevated location. It was probably, based on the best evidence I have in a photo here, it was at probably a 1917.4 elevation. It's a, you know, on the bottom of the creek. The creek bed at that location is probably 1907, about 10 feet of water in the creek there. And you actually can see the bridge is way underwater there, too, at that snapshot in time. So the creek did rise significantly from that slide. It had no effect. The creek's still flowing at this location, 1904. No effects downstream. It was just built up in this area. Amazingly, that water was just pooled behind here all the way along here. You can actually see the width of it in here. Or it used to be real narrow. That creek is just very deep and wide in that location, immediately following that. The next photo I have is August of 11th. Not a lot of change to the creek. Slides there. At that time, though, late that fall, this picture was taken August of 11th. Late that fall, that's my understanding, the diversion channel was constructed from this location where this red line was. Late in the year, sometime probably October, November is the best date I have on that. Again, the south fields, everything in white is just kind of concentrating on stuff in yellow. That's changes photo to photo. White stuff is just from the previous photo, no change really. So kind of concentrate on white, you know. And this is what's changed in this photo, or excuse me, concentrate on what's yellow. What's changed is the channel was constructed sometime after the date. Base flows are still high. The bridge is still under water. Nothing had really changed. Next photo I have, June of 12. Again, here shows actual diversion was constructed from here to here. That's the high flow diversion channel. There's an approach with two large culverts that was constructed so the Voigts could cross into their farmstead through this diversion channel. The county road still traveled around here. The inlet to that channel, based on my elevation, my best estimate based off our surveys back in 2012 was 1912.2. The creek bottom just in front of that diversion channel is 1906.5, just in front of where the diversion started, meaning the diversion was elevated above the original creek bottom quite a bit. There's a plug that was installed here. They call it a channel block with a base flow culvert that goes through it. There's a 30-inch culvert that allows some base flow from the creek to travel through here and would travel, was designed to travel along here through the white line, travel across the set of culverts to be installed there and travel back. So there's some base load designed in this system. So there's always water coming through the Voigt's farmstead, you know, through this 30-inch culvert and an 18-inch culvert at the north end. At this time, June of 12th, this culvert was not installed yet. At that snapshot time, the culverts are still sitting here, actually, in the photo. And then the other thing, during that year, June, I'm going to go back, June of 12, we started doing our baseline work in August of that year. We installed our first monitoring well. That's that well you'll see that I reported earlier, 12-20B. That was installed in August, and we took our first well reading on that time frame at 1912.56 on August 12th. Again, based on our survey, made really close to the baseline surveyation of the creek, too. I mean, those elevations are very similar at that snapshot in time. And when I say the creek elevation, that's right at this location upstream of the bridge crossing. And again, here's the other stuff, relative creek, hayfield, and those types. So that's what occurred between fall of 11 and June of 12. The next photo I got is August of 13. Not a lot of change. The only thing I really noticed up in this photo, you're starting to see some pretty major head cutting right here. There's a little waterfall started right here where the creek is starting to head cut back, and it was at this location at that snapshot in time. No other significant changes to elevations. The system was functioning just as it was the year before. This culvert here still was not installed. The culverts are still sitting there in the photo here. Our monitoring well is still there, but nothing, you know, still recording elevations on it. I didn't show the new elevations for that time. So that was August the 13th. The next one I jumped to is October 15. We have, Google had no photos, and I had nothing from 14. The mine had no photos, so I have no photos to represent what was occurring in 14, so I had to jump to October 15. At that snapshot in time, you know, the culvert was installed at that time, so sometime, you know, after the previous photo to here, that culvert was definitely installed for the base flow to work, function in this area. But what did happen, August of 14, in August of 14, this approach blew out. That had access to the Voigt's farmstead right here. And when it blew out, also there's significant erosion in the creek, as you can see in here. This creek, at that time, diversion channel inlet eroded to elevation 1909.7, about 2.5 feet below where it was the previous photo. So the creek, you know, there's a 2009.7 here, and the creek bottom is actually down below it quite a way. So there's still room for erosion to occur. So that controlled the water elevation, 1909.7, that backed water up to this location, but the bridge crossing now is actually sitting here. And late that fall, that existing structure, the county replaced that structure that was there with a concrete box culvert in November of 15. The county came along and installed a new box culvert late that year. Didn't show up in this image because the image was before that. And when they installed that, that created a new space flow surface around 1911. The backside of that. One other thing to note, no base flow since erosion of high flow. Right now, base flow water goes this direction. It cannot make it to this culvert. So this culvert will function when the creek gets high enough to reach it. It's at elevation 1910, the culvert in that diversion ditch. At that time, is a foot above the channel. So the base flow water didn't make it. It's not making it there. It does get water, but when the creek gets high enough. September 16, the changes we're seeing in this one, diversion channel is continuing to erode in that year. Appears to us, based on, looks like the elevation now is 1909.2 at this location here, 3 feet below the constructed diversion elevation. Does show the new box culvert the county installed, and its inlet is at 1910, inlet to that box culvert. So that basically controls the water level behind here. Their structure will hold the water at 1910. So at that snapshot in time with base flow, we're about 1910.4, means there's about 4/10 of water flowing in through that structure. So that was what year, September 16. October 17, diversion still eroding. New elevation is about 1908.7. Flowing So the base flow behind that's 1908.7, but it only backs up to the county structure, and the county structure holds that water at 1910.4 back here. No change back here because the county's box culvert controls the elevation of the creek behind there. October of 18, again, continued eroding. Diversion channel eroded to elevation 1908. It's about 4 feet below the original constructed elevation. So that controls the base flow behind here up to this area. So there's water backed up to the culvert, to the riprap of this culvert here at elevation 1908. Creek bottom still about 1906.5 at this location. So, and the last photo here was taken this fall. I took added a few more elevations, but that location we've been tracking along now is down to 1907. It's about 5.2 feet below the constructed diversion elevation. The creek at that location is 1906.5, so it's almost down to the original creek bed. It's about 6 inches away from the original creek bed at this location. So it's getting close to finding, I guess, happy spot here. There's other elevations along it. It's pretty flat through here, 1907, and it goes to 1906.8, 1906.3. Until it gets down to the original creek, it's probably never changed down there. Base flow is 1904 down in here. So,
Don.
Okay.
On that last one, October 19th. What? Okay, go down a little bit, or the other way.
This way.
Yeah, you got that base flow at surface elevation 1904.
Yep.
What's where it goes around the bend there? What's sort of at the top of that?
This?
No, keep going. Right there.
Oh, just sediment accumulations? Yeah, if you really note the photos here, I suppose I should be. I mean, obviously, we did a calculation here based on 2009. We've calculated there's been 10,000 yards of soil been eroded out of here since it started eroding. Obviously, a little bit each year. The biggest significant year was the first year, but based on a survey conducted this year, 10,000 cubic yards have left this area and been transported upstream towards our box culvert. A lot of it you can see deposited. If you really look at the photos, if you pull up in Google Earth, you'd see a lot of those depositions are occurring, you know, all the way along here. But you really see it, you know, in these areas, especially in the first half mile, you see a lot, or quarter mile, of that deposition there.
I have no further questions for Mr. Steffen.
Mr. Broughton, do you have questions?
Yes, sir. Mr. Steffen, if you look at CCMC 11, there's that picture from the voids exhibit. I understand what you're saying about sediment coming from upstream, but does it not appear obvious to you that there's radiation of the sediment coming out from these rocks here?
No, it's very obvious. It's just the opposite.
Do you see the lines?
Yep.
Pointing away from the rocks?
Yeah.
That doesn't indicate to you?
No, that's our clean water flowing through there and scouring down, exposing that scoria.
Okay. And your water is discharged, well, at this time when this picture was taken, the water was being discharged up above that sediment area. Is that right?
Which photo?
The one on top of CCMC.
I don't know if water's discharged. I didn't know there was water discharged in this photo. I don't see it.
The black tube there?
Yeah, there's a pipe there, but isn't running at that day, is it? Is it running?
No, but had it never been discharged before that day?
Oh, yeah, we've discharged this pond, yes.
Right, and what I'm saying is when you discharge, it's discharging right around where you stop seeing the pipe there, right? That's the end of the pipe?
I don't know for sure that's the pipe, but I don't know if we were discharging. We might have moved that pipe before we discharged. I'd have to look at the exact time it discharged. We do move those pipes around. Fit this. Before we discharge, we look at the outlets and we will move them time to time. Once every discharge, we may move it to a different location to make sure it's adequately placed to dissipate the energy. So that pipe might have been just laying there out of the way for some reason. I don't know.
How do you move move it to make sure it's adequately placed to dissipate the energy?
We'd place it on some of the best rocks we can observe so it dissipates the energy properly there.
Why do you do that?
It's because that's a requirement of the PSC. Why? Dissipate energy to don't create erosion.
Because if you don't do that, it'll create erosion?
Potentially, yes. If you don't drop it on rocks or things like that. If you just drop it in the dirt, but we have rocks here, we dissipate through that rock riprap.
But then it goes over those rocks and into the dirt, right?
It goes over the rocks into the creek, yes.
Through the dirt?
No dirt, no.
So there's no dirt under these rocks?
There's a fabric liner underneath there to keep it from going underneath the rocks. It's a fabric liner. You can see, there's a line. All our rock riprap is lined with fabric.
You have Exhibit 8.
I don't have Exhibit 8. Your Exhibit 8?
Yeah.
I don't.
That's a sediment fence, right?
Correct.
That was overtopped by erosion?
I can't for sure tell that by the photo.
You can't tell by looking at that photo that there's
no,
going
I can't.
All the way up to
I
the
see
top?
It was right to the top, but I don't know if it went over.
You're claiming that you've never had sediment go over that fence?
I don't know. I personally never seen it myself visually go over, but it potentially could have, yes.
And that sediment would then go down toward those rocks, right?
Yes.
Did you hear, you have an engineering background, right?
Yes.
Did you hear Mr. Bofto's testimony yesterday about the effect that those box culverts have on a flowing creek and the fact that that's going to cause that stream to slow down?
Yes, I explained that too here today, yeah.
You agree with that, that water is going to slow down as it gets those box culverts?
The stream will slow down, yes.
Page 12 of Exhibit 8. Can you tell me what's going on in that photo?
Look at it closely. That's a backhoe, and it appears to be working in the vicinity of our box culvert here.
Okay.
Just based off of general knowledge. Can't see for sure, but it looks like it.
No further questions.
Mr. Hsu, any question?
Yes, Your Honor. So before there was riprap at the discharge outlet, and then it was replaced with concrete mat, isn't that right?
Correct.
And why was that?
I didn't like the placement of the riprap. I was pretty fussy about it, and I always wanted to replace this with concrete matting. I really like concrete matting. It's clean. It's effective. So every place I've been trying to replace some of these key locations, especially where we dissipate energy from ponds, I'd like to replace it with concrete matting, just much cleaner looking.
Was that done at the urging of the PSC staff?
They suggested we do some work to that area one time. I don't know if it was this time, but I don't think they've, that rock riprap and stuff, I think they like that concrete matting also. So
sure.
I'm sure they've urged it, and I like it too, so we concur.
Okay. Now, most of this focus has been on the south box culvert, but I believe the voice also brought up some photographs showing that the northern box culvert had some sedimentation as well.
Yep.
What would you say was the cause of that sediment buildup?
Same cause.
Even though that this one seemed to be focused mostly on the diversion channel causing a lot of the sediment buildup?
No, that sediment came from upstream again. If you look real close, I wasn't prepared, so I couldn't prepare exhibits, but it was very obvious to me. When we discharge our water down that area, it's the same thing, a little stream about 2 feet wide and 6 inches deep. That sediment was 3 feet up on the bank definitely same exact thing. It was from that water slowing down at that location, leaving a deposit of sediment. It's just so obvious by the pictures if you look at them.
Now, this is from the informal conference we had, and I know you had some discussion about the sediment buildup. I remember you saying that regardless of the source of this, that the company would probably just go out and dredge it out if the buildup got to the point where I'm assuming impeding the creek.
Yeah.
You recall that?
Yes.
At what point would the company be looking at doing that?
If it was continuously all the way across, maybe a foot at least, I would say I'd be looking at doing it a foot above where it's going to affect the hydraulics of those boxes, and I don't see that today.
Okay. Do you think it's close to that point, or do you think it's a ways off?
No, I'd say there's probably a one-fourth of it probably has that in it. You got to remember that one thing to point out in this box that you guys don't see or don't realize during the design, this entire box culvert structure was dropped in the stream bed 1 foot at the request of Corps engineers. So underneath all that sediment is concrete matting. You don't see it. That is full of concrete matting under the erosion control protection.
Sure.
It's down there. It's just that was part of the design by the Corps to drop this in the creek bed 1 foot with the intent to let sediment come in there, I'm assuming. They never told us why, but that was a request in our special condition or permit to make sure we put this box and the concrete matting in front of it down 1 foot. So all that sediment sitting on concrete matting in there, too. So we got to be careful. That was an intent to leave some of that sediment in there, obviously. And I'm thinking it was for the fisheries. I don't know. They never told us why we have to put it in 1 foot deep. Nobody else does that, but we did. But I'm thinking it was for the fisheries to keep, naturally, it'll fill back with sediment, that foot. So, and they want some of that sediment in there, obviously, I'm thinking, and at least that foot.
Well, I'm sure you're familiar with the remedy that the voids have requested. I'm curious because do you guys currently take monthly photographs or monitor it on a monthly basis?
That culvert location is driven by every employee, every hour, every day, thousands of times a year. We do not keep a log, though. I mean, that is probably every employee has to pass by that culvert to get to their work area. Every PSC inspector comes by that every inspection. Right. That thing is more inspected more than any piece of land on our property.
I guess how burdensome would it be to create a log of that?
I think it's unnecessary.
Sure.
Where do we start? I log everything I do? No, it's unnecessary.
Sure. I understand it's unnecessary, but it would be difficult to do on a monthly basis when it's not frozen.
What's that?
I understand that you believe it's unnecessary, but would it be difficult to do?
Difficult? It's just a requirement that, if we don't do it, we're going to get a violation because we didn't inspect it. It's like, no, I don't want something that now you come back and, oh, we forgot to inspect this. It's not required. Let's not do it.
Sure. Okay. Well, that's all the questions I have.
Commissioner Chrisman, any questions?
Yes, Your Honor. In looking at this map where you labeled that the approach with two large culverts was installed sometime in the late 2011 or 2012.
Correct. June 2012 photos you want me to look at? Okay.
There it appears, the previous one that does not. Yes. Okay, so from that point, where that is, and then going south, down toward about the north edge of that, base full culvert, that little area, as I gauge through these one after another, your dotted blue line that indicates the water flow seems to be going farther and farther west on this huge map. So is that just kind of roughing it in so we can see that blue line?
My blue line's pretty rough.
Or does that indicate that is too old a year after year, farther and farther to the west?
Don't look. My blue line is pretty rough. That was just to give you general representation. It was not to design the exact spot where water's flowing.
But now those culverts are not there when they drive over the bottom culvert and kind of compress themselves.
Yeah, correct. It shows up on some of those later folders, yeah.
So that's kind of that's the road. That's not something
No, that's...
Here's a better way to phrase it. Is there a plan to replace those two box culverts where they were part of the stings?
I'm sorry, I didn't have the phone on. Do you know, is there a plan to replace those two box culverts, or is this the planned road for them?
I don't know.
And is this area in, this is in the mine permit area, right?
Yes, it is.
And so, do you have liability for what happens up there, whether it's your responsibility or not, or your causing or not, but do you have liability for what happens on the mine site, but where you're not actively mining?
No, no liability for that.
Okay. No other questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Crosius.
Thank you, Your Honor. Can you tell me what the flow rate variance is for Coyote Creek?
Flow rate variance for CFF base flow? I would put your base flow at probably, my estimate is between 6 and 10 CFS cubic feet per second. That's 3,000 to 4,000 gallons a minute, somewhere around that range, base flow. Full flow, 3,000 to 4,000 CFS, maybe. Okay. I don't know. I've never checked that, I guess. But base flow, my estimate is between that 8 and 10 CFS, or right around that range.
Peaks in the spring after heavy rainfall.
Yeah, it comes up, and it'll, like Casey said, it hasn't broke out of the bank, I think, since August of 14, but he's observed it breaking out of the bank many times in the past, yes.
Okay. Does it slow not to a trickle, but considerably in, say, August?
It's always got a pretty good base flow of that. That's the base flow. So slowest I've ever seen it probably was in 17, that drought year, but it's still flowed. It's never, we've been down there involved for 7-8 years. I've never seen it stop flowing.
So the sediment below the box culvert, shown in exhibit 11, your exhibit, CCMC 11. Question I have is, in it would be the top photo in exhibit 11. Does that wash out, scour out in the spring, for example, and then build again throughout the summer months? Or
yeah, it scours itself. That's where you see that flow going through there. It self scours, yes.
Okay, then the photo below, that is a different box culvert. Is that correct, or is that
the same box culvert, just dated a couple years later?
Okay, so there, though, it's showing a fair amount of vegetation that doesn't look like just 1 year's worth of vegetation on top, growing out of the sediment.
I think their photo is from 17, and ours is 19, I believe, so it's a couple of years. I believe their photo was 17. I don't have that in front of me. Top photo was 2017, I believe. I'm not positive, though. And it was never given that date at the formal, so I couldn't put it on mine, but I think they presented it here.
Okay, and then on the photo below from September 19th, 2019, there's a little cut after the concrete matting. Looks like it would be straight down from the pipe. I'm assuming that's scoured out from the discharge when water is...
Yeah, because we, at this point, we had, I can't see. I'm not sure what you're looking at either, but there's just a little dimple there below our pipes, maybe, where it hits the creek. Yep. Right. Yeah, that's where our pipe discharge water would probably flow off onto the... Keep in mind, underneath that grass, there is other concrete matting that you don't see. Underneath all that vegetation, and there is some matting down there that I described. It's down underneath, but there by design. You just don't see it. It's covered up with sediment.
Okay, then. Going to the bottom photo, which is, the top photo. I take that back, this one again. On your exhibit 11, CCMC 11 or void exhibit 8, you are saying that the scoria deposit would have come from upstream and been layered on top of the sediment.
Yeah, it would come in there at the same time. Usually the scoria would be deposited at the same time, and then as the creek starts rescinding, you know, their finer particles will land on top of it, probably covering it up. They were probably originally covered with finer materials from the second phase of settling, you know, as that water starts dropping, the fines start dropping out. So, and when we discharged that pond, it probably exposed that scoria. Our water running across it did expose the scoria at the few places we discharged water. So,
how often would you discharge water from the pond?
We've did it 12 times since 15, but 2 to 3 times a year is our typical, probably. 3 times a year, the 4, probably.
As the one last question on CCMC 16 from August of 2009 to October 2019. Were you in communication with the Voits throughout that entire time frame on what was happening, why it was occurring?
No, we really weren't in communication with them on that subject. I think we probably communicated in 14 a little bit on that subject after it blew out. All this communication then, but I can't say we've had a lot of communication with them on that subject since then.
Any access issues when the box culvert was placed?
They worked with or county no. did that box culvert, so they worked with the Voits during that time frame. Right access, I'm sure.
Yeah. All right, no other questions. Thank you,
Commissioner Fedorchak. Thank you, Judge. This sediment buildup. I'm looking at the requested action from the Voits for this issue. Do you look at, and they want you guys to inspect it on a monthly basis. This is an area that the discharge, erosion, sediment content in the discharge, this is an area that our staff works and follows, isn't it?
Yes.
Do you go to these places with our staff on a fairly consistent basis?
I've been with them on frequent inspections where you stop to look at that location, yes, myself.
Okay. Have they raised any issues or concerns?
I'm only aware of one time we were discharged, and then I think they were looking at, I think somebody made a recommendation, maybe we should look at replacing this area like you do in other areas with the concrete matting. So
okay.
They made a because, I mean, granted, they probably saw the rocks and said, they've seen some other installation we did at, and they liked it, and so, hey, why don't you do it here?
Yeah.
So I did do it with that, and I like it too, like I discussed earlier.
What about the sediment buildup that's kind of behind the discharge in the box culvert? Has that come up?
I can't say it ever come up when I've been on inspection with them.
Okay.
But I don't go on very many.
You probably would have heard about it if it was flagged as an issue.
Oh, yeah.
And then the remedy for that, who's responsible for that, keeping that channel clean?
We would be, yes.
Okay. Regardless of the cause?
Regardless of where the sediment came from, it's our responsibility to keep it clean, yes.
Okay. And at what point do you have to go in and do that? Like, how do you... You might have mentioned this earlier, but...
I probably will clean it next year, but reason I didn't, we were in there replacing that concrete matting, and I would have did it while we were there. We were there with a backhoe, and I didn't want to touch it because the time frame. I didn't like the time frame. We were in there in April, late April, and by our original core permits, you weren't allowed to disturb the stream.
Mm.
I didn't think April 15th to June 15th is kind of a no-no in stream.
Sure.
Don't go in and dredge in streams because the fisheries... I remember that from installation, so that's why I didn't touch it. We were there. I should have did it, but I couldn't because our core permit at that time had limitations on that time frame.
Okay.
So I just think it was wise to affect the fisheries.
But what sorts of testing is done on your discharges
It's an effluent discharge. We test for iron, pH, total suspended solids.
And then do you have to, every time you discharge, is there any sort of a form you have to fill out, or you have to keep track every time you're discharging what your tests showed?
Yes, we test that. Every discharge is tested. We monitor flow, the quantity and quality of it, and it's reported to the Department of Environmental Quality.
Okay, so that's DEQ. Does our staff look at that and the sediment in the discharge at all?
I think they get CC'd in on those. Yes.
I thought I remembered some talk about that on an inspection I went on, but I'm not an inspector. So I could have heard it wrong, but I thought it seems to me that our staff focuses quite a lot on the sediment ponds, just the water quality, how it's being discharged, erosion at discharge points. So I guess what I'm getting to is I feel like through our normal inspection process, the actions that the voids are requesting are already taking place, maybe not on a monthly basis, but certainly in a timely enough manner that if there's issues, they'd be resolved.
Correct.
That's your impression?
That's my impression, yes.
I guess we'll talk to staff about that as well. All right, thank you.
Mr. Mann, any redirect?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Are there any other questions? Mr. Broughton, go ahead.
Mr. Steffen, you said that you liked the concrete matting better than the riprap because it's better at controlling erosion. Did I hear that right?
No, I like it just because I like it as a better dissipator. I don't think it depends on the erosion. It could be not as good as it could be actually be concrete. Riprap can be more effective depending on your flows and stuff. But
what's the benefit of having a better energy dissipator?
It's just better.
Why does it matter?
I just like it better. I just like concrete matting better.
Why does it matter if something is better at dissipating energy?
You want the best dissipator you can provide.
Why?
To stop any potential erosion.
Erosion of what? Dirt and rock.
Dirt and rock, if you're dumping on the dirt and rock. We put energy dissipators so you don't have any. Either way, you don't have any from these pipes.
You have
getting
that
it.
Dirt and rock erosion. Where would it go?
I couldn't hear you.
If you had that dirt and rock erosion, where would it go?
If we had it, we never had it.
Where would it go if you did?
Where would it go? It would go at wherever the flow takes it.
Toward the stream.
Towards the stream, if there was a stream, yeah.
No further questions.
Mr. Hsu?
Thank you, Your Honor. There's just one question that I think staff want a clarification on. I believe you said this earlier, but did Coyote Creek Mine replace the box culvert by the Void Farm, said the south one? Was that for the county or was that for the mine?
We did not replace that box culvert. Okay, so the county replaced that box culvert.
Thank you.
All right. Any further questions for Mr. Steffen? All right. Thank you, Mr. Steffen. Mr. Mann, do you have anything further?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Hsu. No, did you want to present staff members?
Yes, Your Honor. How are we doing on time, Derek?
We're going to probably get 220.
220? Okay. We might have enough time for one, and if we need a break, we can do that as well.
Sure.
I think to start off, why don't we have Mr. Welch take a stand? I spoke with staff, and they're willing to field some questions as well as just kind of generally comment on the issues that we're here to discuss. For the most part, Mr. Welch will be speaking to access, fugitive dust, and sediment buildup. Does that sound right, Guy?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Before you testify, Mr. Welch, were you in the room this morning when I went through the penalties for perjury?
Yes.
You heard those?
Yes.
Do you understand what perjury is?
Yes.
And being advised on the penalties of perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this case today?
I do.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Your Honor, actually, before we get started, I do have the CVs for all the staff members. I don't know if the parties would be willing to stipulate to them, just for the purpose of time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
PSC 2, 3, and 4 into the record.
Okay. In the order you handed?
Yes, sir. That'd be okay. Fine. Mr. Welch, will you please state your name for the record?
Guy Welch.
Okay, and what's your current position with PSC?
I'm an environmental scientist 3 with the Reclamation Division.
Sure, and how long have you been working for the Reclamation Division?
Since 1998, April of 1998.
All right, will you just quickly give us a summary of your qualifications?
Excuse me. I have a cold I'm kind of trying to get over.
Sure.
I have a bachelor's degree in range science from South Dakota State University, and I've worked as a range and soil conservationist for a number of federal and state agencies, BLM, NRCS, and North Dakota State Land Department was the name at the time.
Have you testified in front of the commission before?
No.
Okay. And in what capacity have you been involved with the Coyote Creek Mine?
I'm a primary inspector at the Coyote Creek Mine. Have been since its inception. I review the permit. I'm primarily responsible for certain areas of permit, but that aren't necessarily excluded from certain areas. But I primarily deal with revegetation. I look at land use, landowner preference statements, and so on and so forth.
So you reviewed the renewal and the revision that is the subject of the hearing today?
I did.
Okay. And why don't we briefly speak about access? I know you heard all the testimony, reviewed the permits, and seen all the exhibits. Do you currently believe the Coyote Creek Mine is in compliance with all the applicable statutes and regulations?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have any other comments regarding access that you'd like to provide?
No.
Okay. While we move on to fugitive dust, I'm just going to briefly touch on this as well, just because you're an inspector at the mine.
Okay.
During your inspections, have you ever observed things similar to what the voids have displayed with their photographs regarding fugitive dust today?
Not to that extent. I mean, it's common to see some dust, a limited amount of dust. I've never in 21 years seen the kind of dust that's been shown in the videos and the photos.
Okay.
At any mines, including Coyote Creek Mine.
Right. And how often do you generally inspect the mine?
This mine or any mine?
Coyote Creek Mine.
It varies. I think I was at the mine probably a half a dozen times since last year.
Okay.
It kind of varies depending on the season of when I'm called to go there.
Sure. I guess just from your inspections, then would you consider that those photographs an atypical or typical for dust that you see at the mine?
Atypical.
Okay. Let's see. I believe you also were prepared to speak generally to the sediment buildup as well.
Yes.
Okay, and are you aware if the company has met the effluent performance standards that are required of them?
To my knowledge, every time they've discharged, they've met the standards required by DEQ.
Okay, and how do you know that? Does DEQ provide that to you, or is that provided directly to you?
I don't look at the water reports, so it's a little bit out of my wheelhouse, if you will, but we do receive entering we do receive quarterly monitoring reports and then annual reports from the mine, and the records are on file at the mine during complete inspections.
Okay. If the effluent actions aren't met, would they need to at least provide that to you in those quarterly reports, or would that be on an immediate basis after those effluent standards aren't met?
Mining companies can only discharge when the water is clean enough to discharge. So if they shouldn't be discharging dirty water, you follow me? And we do, during inspections, we typically try to look at water being discharged to confirm turbidity, if you will.
Okay. So I guess both parties brought forward a number of photos showing sediment buildup. Have you, why don't we go specifically to the south box culvert that was discussed today?
Okay.
Have you in the past, do you believe that sediment buildup is a result of activities from the mining company?
I can't say with certainty one way or another where that sediment came from. I can't say it didn't, and I can't say it did.
Okay, well, how would we say without certainty? Do you think there might have, they might have contributed to it?
I think it's possible that there could have been erosion underneath the large riprap boulders, and that soil from underneath those boulders deposited down, you know, into the stream.
Sure. And so were you the staff that suggested that the concrete matting be placed? Or was that a different PSC staff member?
I can't remember with 100% certainty that was me, but it could have been.
Okay. Was that request as a result of the concerns that maybe some of that sediment deposition was from some of the activities from the mine?
I recall an inspection in 2018 where there was something going on. You know, the discharge water was clean, but this is not this crossing. This is the other crossing, Section 19, but the water was clean. And but yet where the water by the discharge in the creek was somewhat cloudy, and I couldn't figure it out. I believe Jessica was with me that day. But didn't make any sense, and it didn't dawn on me until I actually left the mine. I was on our way back here, and I said, I think there might be some erosion occurring underneath that large rip rock. And I subsequently called the mine, and they had shut down, and sure. That area was reconstructed or restabilized.
I guess the actions that the mine has taken, did that satisfy your concerns regarding the sediment deposition?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have anything else you'd like to add regarding the sediment deposition or the fugitive dust? I don't think I gave you an opportunity to speak to that as well. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No.
Okay. Why don't you just generally comment on the testimony that was presented regarding the reclamation practices of the mine?
The permit is in compliance with the requirements of rule and law. It's with revision 9, they built in some flexibility to delay seedings in some areas. Quite frankly, it's the areas under variance is where the delayed seedings have been allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And for the reasons that were stated this morning to control invasive perennial grasses.
Sure. Could you explain the Cuyahoga Creek's variances for the contemporaneous reclamation requirements?
Repeat that?
Would you just explain the variances for the contemporaneous reclamation requirements?
Okay, right. The commission can grant variances from the 180-day backfilling and grading rule and from the three-year requirement to seed at 3 years after coal removal. And it's quite common that variances to the 180-day rule are granted at all the mines, quite frankly, especially when you first start opening a new pit area. At this mine, there's also reasons because of the pre-benching that is occurring, and sometimes it's simply the length of pit and the timing of how long the drag line can make a full cycle. But there's also a variance from the four peak back grading within four spoil peaks. And then finally, there's a variance from the actual initiation of revegetation, which is supposed to occur within 3 years of coal removal.
What changes have occurred to the previously approved reclamation schedule with Revision 9?
They added variance areas 5 and 6, which are quite small areas, and they removed the the area that was to be mined in 2019 from the variance, the previous approved variance area. That's what I see according to the Pitlout facility map.
Okay. Do you now, you remember we discussed, or I believe Mr. Anderson discussed, about the omission of the Kentucky bluegrass from the reclamation requirements. Would you just touch on that briefly?
I think we're referring to the October 1st inspection.
Right.
Where do you stop and start in terms of on an inspection report? I thought the information was adequate. As I think about it now, I don't know that I seen a lot of it, but I do recall seeing some native desirable perennial grasses growing also, but I probably didn't mention them either in the inspection report. So it's I don't think it's a big deal. I think the fact that I didn't say that, I think it's part of the plan for the mining company's plan is to delay reclamation to get those species under control.
Okay.
Prior to seeding the approved native mix.
Okay. One of the suggestions regarding reclamation has been to allow Mr. Voigt the opportunity to, do a site visit to the reclaimed land or to visually inspect the reclamation process. Mm-hmm. And I know they discussed that should be covered by the lease. However, if he requested an inspection from the PSC, mm-hmm. would the staff be able to grant that inspection as well?
Yes.
Okay, that's within the authority of the PSC staff as well?
We usually don't. If it's something like Casey called and wanted to look at something, mm-hmm. I would probably let the mining company know what was planned. If they want to participate, fine. If not, fine. But I guess let me back up. That'd be up to Dean, not me. but as a rule, I don't think we have anything to reasons not to grant such a request.
Sure. Well, we'll ask Dean when he gets up there.
Okay.
I guess having a lot of background in revegetation, then do you have any thoughts on the special condition requiring the mine to use certified seed-free or weed-free mulch, straw, and seed?
Just as Jessica Unruh mentioned, I also Googled in having worked for the North Dakota Department of Ag, actually in the Noxious Weeds Division, I knew they were beginning to put together a weed seed-free forage program. that program, if I understand it, I Googled it, and I'm not an expert on it, but just quickly, I think it's really designed for national parks and the Forest Service area where people may take horses in and go trail riding and bring some hay along for their horses. But as Ms. Unruh mentioned, it's really designed for state-listed noxious weeds. If you look at the actual list, though, it includes other plants that, like the national invasive species list. So it may include more than just state-listed noxious weeds, but kochia, for example, is on that list in this. One of the species that should not be in mulch. So I guess just briefly, it's really designed for noxious weeds, and it's the availability, according to the website, there's not probably a lot available. And I think that'd be way too prescriptive of a condition to put on a permit. Sure. I think the way, for example, Coteau Properties does it, they actually generate a lot of their own mulch, so they know firsthand what it is they're baling, and then and make sure it's dry so it's suitable as mulch.
Sure. Do you have any other issues with the reclamation as it currently sits with the renewal and the revision?
No.
Okay. I'm going to take you one step back, too, because I thought we could briefly discuss the sediment buildup, the remedy requested by the voice on that issue. Now, they're suggesting that a visual inspection be done by Coyote Creek on a monthly basis. And I thought, just for the purposes of discussion, how often do you think that that box culvert, or the box culverts in general, get inspected by staff throughout the year? Do you think that's on a monthly basis, a bi-monthly, or bi-monthly basis, once a quarter?
I'd say probably once a quarter, for sure. I just can only speak for myself, quite frankly, but that's an area that I've probably looked at every time I've been there.
Sure.
And especially if a discharge is occurring.
Okay. So this is something that you feel that staff has been monitoring and will continue to monitor?
Yes.
I guess that's all the questions I have. Mr. Welch, is there anything else you need to add?
No.
The record?
No.
Okay.
All right. It's 2:18, so I think we'll probably break there since Mr. Broughton has to do his phone conference, and we will reconvene at 3 o'clock.
I think so. I'll let you know if that's going to take longer for any reason, but I don't think it will.
Okay. All right, we're going to get started again. It is 2:58 p.m. Just so everybody's aware, if we're not done by 10 after 4, we need to take another break till at least 4:30.
Right.
Okay. Mr. Welch, if you want to take the stand again. Mr. Broughton, did you have any questions for Mr. Welch?
Yeah, just a couple. Mr. Welch, would you agree that with respect to the weeds in the variance areas, that'd be better if they're cut or sprayed before they go to seed?
I would agree.
And you'd mentioned that you do approximately quarterly inspections in that box culvert area. Do you or whoever does that generate a report when that happens?
Yes.
Okay. That's all the questions I have.
Mr. Mann, any questions?
No, Your Honor.
Commissioner Christman?
Regarding that grade 4 where the weeds were, did you inspect that over the course of the summer?
I was at the Coyote Creek Mine in July of this year and then in late August. I was close to the area in July, and I was actually against the grade approval 5 that had been recently respread and seeded. But it was after like 2.5 inches of rain, like the day before. So I didn't intensely look at grade approval 4 during that inspection and hadn't until October 1st.
Okay. You were there for the October 1st inspection?
Yes.
Do you see any indication that those weeds were let go to seed as opposed to cut and kept as just erosion control?
Yeah, I think, I think there was evidence that it had been cut earlier in the growing season just based on the height. I mean, the Russian thistle was, foot tall or something in that area as opposed to being fully grown tumbleweed, if you will. So,
Do you agree with, and I'll just say, my characterization of Ms. Unruh's priorities, that the invasive grass species and noxious weeds are the far more important issue to, and erosion, I guess, are the most important issues more so than the annual weeds?
I agree that perennial, invasive perennial grasses and noxious weeds are much more concerning than annual weeds.
And does this thing make sense to you, having dealt with mining and long-term reclamation of large tracts, to possibly hold off on the seeding of some small tracts till they can be combined up and be in sync with others to make a sizable tract so that grazing can be used for control?
I agree with it. you know, that's it's common that there's areas cut off by haul roads that just aren't manageable. And the 10-year liability period starts when the native grass species are seeded, initially seeded. So delaying in anticipating a bond release tract, you're really not delaying bond release on a tract if parts are small parts are initiated over time. It's the last seeding on that tract that's going to be the 10-year reliability period. So approving this delay does not delay bond release potential. So I think it's a good thing to do.
No other questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Crotchus.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of questions, Guy. What was your reaction to the dust on the snow? The photos that were shown in, I believe, Exhibit 12. Do you recall the exhibit that showed
yep.
the photos?
Yep.
Okay. So what was your reaction to that in terms of wind erosion or the cause of it?
Mm-hmm.
From hauling, the trucks kicking up the dust, from the...
Yeah. First, let me say, Dean is really the one that's going to talk on fugitive dust, not myself.
Oh,
that's right. But having said that, it's bad. I mean, those pictures are bad. I don't think there's no other way to characterize it. We've seen those pictures during the informal conference, and I thought it appropriate to add a condition to Revision 9.
How often did you see those types of conditions out there during the winter months?
I've never seen anything in 21 years of inspecting is what was shown in the videos at this mine or any others.
All right, no other questions.
Commissioner Fedorchuk.
Okay, thank you, Guy. You mentioned earlier some, I think you mentioned one of the requirements that the voids had asked for as being as you know, an accommodation or a addendum to the permit as being too prescriptive. So can you just speak generally in your years in doing this, what's the benefit for you as an inspector to have things not real prescriptive and having more flexibility built into the permitting process versus prescription? How might that help you as inspectors and ultimately improve the reclamation process?
Yeah, if we're talking about reclamation, the reclamation schedule specifically. Mm-hmm. Right. I think what I was saying is I think having weed-free mulch is pretty prescriptive on, you know, whereas there's other options that might work just as good. It was my only point I was trying to make there.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of a mining company having flexibility, I think it's almost necessary. If you look at, for example, NRCS's recommended timing of seeding of native grasses, they're going to have a window in the spring, a window in late summer, and then a dormant fall seeding. But the reality is at the mines for the last 20 years, I can only think of one or two failed native grass seedings when they seed outside the recommended windows that NRCS recommends. So I think it's really important that a mining company have flexibility if the moisture conditions are there. You know, and it might be the 15th of June, do it. So I think it's really important that mining companies have flexibility, but we also know what's transpired and what's planned and that they follow through with what's planned.
Mm-hmm. So how do you guys up there on 13th floor with your staff balance that? And this is probably a question I'll ask Dean too, but the flexibility versus prescription. I mean, how do you walk that balance? They're asking for some more prescriptive things in their requirements here, in their ask. Most of them are asking for additional things on the permit. And so I guess how do you balance what's, you know, reasonable, responsible, necessary versus this might be too restrictive or prescriptive?
I think it's a judgment call in case by case and specific to this instance. I think we need to sit back and look and say, are we adding additional higher standards to this mine compared to the other mines? So I think we got to be careful about setting precedences on maybe going too far. Would be something to consider as we look at, for example, a special condition to a permit.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's good. You mentioned that the, let's see here, where I wrote it down, that the can't discharge, mining companies can only discharge when the water is clean enough to do so. Mm-hmm. Do they get permits prior to approval to discharge? Does somebody give that each time?
No, the mining companies have a NDPDS permit from the North Dakota Health Department, or DEQ now, and that sets the parameters about when they can discharge and when we can't in terms of water quality and the testing. So they test their
own water, and then they have to track those tests and follow them with the health department?
Correct. If there is such a thing as an overflow on a sediment pond, they're designed for a 10-year, 24-hour event, for example. And so if you get a rain event above and beyond that and the pond overflows, you know, the mining company is going to let DEQ know, let us know, this is what happened. So there's times when there might be discharges that don't meet the concern, and that's tracked through the permit with the DEQ.
Okay. Prior to the informal conference and then this hearing, were you working with any complaints from the Voights directly, or were they working with us directly, your staff asking questions, et cetera?
Yes and no. In June of 2019, Casey Voight came in to talk to us and talked about a number of things, including dust. I think, if not all the issues we've been discussed here today, and he kind of gave us a heads up, but it wasn't really a complaint. He made us aware of that. Previously, I'd been out there in September of 2018, I believe it was, on a kind of a complaint. And then in between the informal and the formal conference, I met with Casey Voight on an issue at the mine. So,
okay. So you're available, our staff is available to landowners who have issues?
Yes.
And are you guys an intermediary then between the companies to some extent?
It depends on what the issue is.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we our authority is outlined by rule and regulation, and it really just doesn't matter what I think.
Right.
We have to have some basis. So if there's issues that are within our authority, then, of course, we review and get involved, and sometimes they may not be within our authority.
Okay. Any estimate as to how much time you've spent on this issue, on these issues here, leading up to the informal? I'm just curious. I mean, obviously, it's part of our job to deal with this stuff, and we do, but I'm just curious how much time it's you guys.
Probably 10 days.
Okay.
You know, there's inspection. There's write the inspection report. There's digging in. When I met with Casey on the 21st of November, I said, I'm going to look at the permit and review it to make sure the I's are, you know, dotted and the T's are crossed. And that took some time.
10 days. All right. I think that's it for me. Thank you, Guy.
Mr. Hsu, any follow-up?
No follow-up.
All right. Any other questions?
I have one more follow-up, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Guy, let me rephrase the question I had, or not rephrase, but just one more piece, if you would. Have you ever visually seen this yourself when you've been out on inspection?
Well, I haven't seen that, no.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Broughton, did you have a question?
Just a quick one. Back to those inspections that we discussed. Do you give notice of those in advance?
We do not give notice of our routine. We're going to do an inspection, whether it be a partial inspection or a complete inspection. Complete meaning we look at the records also. If Casey Voigt calls and said, you know, has a concern or an issue and wants us to look into it, we'll arrange a time and then I'll let the mining company know that, you know what, I'm going to go in here for a very specific purpose, and they can participate if they want.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Welsh, just for further clarification, the vast majority of inspections, they are not noticed for a purpose, right? Like,
absolutely.
You don't notify the mining company.
Correct. It's the exception to ever notify the mining company that we're going to be there.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Next witness, Mr. Hsu.
Thank you, Your Honor. At this time, I'd like to call Bruce Beachy. And, Your Honor, I believe there's an agreement among the parties to stipulate to his presentation that
okay.
He has provided as well.
That's all the remaining documents?
Yes, Your Honor. If I could have them marked, I think it's PSC 5 now.
Mark them all as one exhibit? That's
yes,
okay.
Your Honor. Yep.
Okay. And I don't think I said it before, but I'll admit into the record then PSC exhibits 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Your Honor, just to flag it for you, Mr. England's got a flight to catch, so he's going to have to duck out at about 3:45
okay.
So people know why he's leaving.
Okay. Mr. Beachy, you were in the room this morning when I went through the penalties for perjury.
I was.
And you you heard those?
I did.
Do you understand what perjury is?
I do.
And being advised on the penalties of perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this case today?
I do.
All right. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Hsu.
Mr. Beachy, please state your name for the record.
Pardon me?
Please state your name for the record.
Bruce Beachy.
Okay. And what's your current position with the PSC?
Current position is hydrologist, and I'm also their staff geologist.
Okay. And would you just briefly summarize your qualifications?
Well, the last 38 years, I've been working as either a geologist or a hydrologist for 36 of those years for the PSC, the last 12 with the Reclamation Division, the prior 25 years or whatever with the Abandoned Mined Lands Division as a project manager. Prior to that, I worked for an oil field engineering company called Schlumberger down in New Mexico and Oklahoma.
And you've testified in front of the commission before,
I have.
Right?
Yes.
In fact, you've testified in front of the commission on alluvial valley floors previously as well, right?
Yep, that is correct.
Okay, and I know you reviewed the renewal and the revision number 9, isn't that right?
I did.
Okay, and I believe you've produced a presentation just to give an overview of your expertise on this matter.
Yeah, this will be a short presentation on alluvial valley floors. This is an issue that has come up in both informal conferences and both formal conferences, and I'm really going to zero in on the subject of sub-irrigation because that was the most recent claim by the Voights that there are some issues with sub-irrigation. They believe their north and south alfalfa fields are sub-irrigated. And I'm just going to provide a short presentation here that I think will prove that these fields are not sub-irrigated. Sure. Having a hard time seeing. Please be patient here. Are these the actual photos? Or? I'm looking for the actual photo. Oh, okay. Second one down, I think. Are they not in order? I can't see. Go ahead and click it. Yep, okay, okay. Is that the first one? Just going to start with a couple of excerpts, a couple of statements from the 1983 OSM Identification and Study Guidelines. That's kind of the Bible for identifying alluvial valley floors. Scrolling down just a little bit, I'm going to read. I've got three of these. I've only got three statements that I'm going to present here today. After that, probably about six or eight photographs, followed by a couple of NDSU Extension Service bulletins, and then some other groundwater data that we've collected. But just sub-irrigation, in terms of the Alluvial Valley Floor Regulatory Program, is the supplying of water to plants from underneath or from a semi-saturated or saturated zone where water is available for use by vegetation. And this, and they actually borrowed that from the SCS back in that day. The last sentence of that paragraph states that implicit in the SCS definition is that groundwater is usable for the entire growing season or a sizable portion of it. And that will come into play in this presentation coming up. The same thing right here, huh? These areas that are highlighted, this wasn't in particular for this formal conference, but it's been over several years of highlighting and studying this document. But in other words, this is once again from the 1983 OSM Identification Study Guidelines, Chapter C, page 10. In other areas, plants may benefit only a little from sub-irrigation because available water is only accessible for a short time. In terms of the Alluvial Valley Floor Regulatory Program, sub-irrigation occurs if enough water is available for a long enough time to have a recognizable effect on the species type and the productivity of a plant community. Then the underlying part there, and this was in the original document, agricultural crops or rangeland must receive enough sub-irrigation that the community is notably more productive or more agriculturally useful when compared to dry land areas. I've got just one more of these. And this is kind of an overarching statement. I know that this was brought up in the last formal hearing, and I think actually Dr. Dave Bickle provided this excerpt from the guidelines, but I think it actually got kind of glossed over, and this is huge. Of special importance in the arid and semi-arid coal mining areas are alluvial valley floors, which are the productive lands that form the backbone of the agricultural and cattle ranching economy of the area. For instance, in the Powder River Basin of eastern Montana and Wyoming, agricultural and ranching operations, which form the basis of the existing economic system of the region, could not survive without hay production from the naturally sub-irrigated and flood-irrigated meadows located along the alluvial valley floors. Then the second paragraph under that says the understanding of an alluvial valley floor is well described in this statement and has been consistently understood in the subsequent passage and implementation of the SMACR, which is Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act of 1977. Every year for probably the last 20 or so years, the Reclamation Division rents an airplane for a year, rents an airplane ride for a day, and goes around to all of the active and sometimes some of the reclamation mines in North Dakota. And this is Coyote Creek. We have a date stamp down here, June 12, 2014. And by all accounts, this was a good precipitation year. This is the shop office facility of Coyote Creek Mine when they're just getting underway. This is the Voits residence back here. This is the north alfalfa field, the lowland alfalfa field. This is the south lowland alfalfa field just across from the Voits. This is in the southeast quarter, section 31. This is in the northeast quarter of section 31. Mining is going on right now over in this area, sections 24, 25, 36, creeping down into section 6. No mining in the valley floor. This dark blotch here is a cloud. Once again, this is from 2014, which was, by all accounts, an excellent precipitation year. Voits also have what they call their upland alfalfa fields in the northeast quarter of section 25. This view is off towards the southwest. This is County Road 13 right here. This is the upland alfalfa fields, I think, consists of 90 to 95 acres. Generally speaking, this was, again, date stamped in 2014, and this crop also appears to be doing very well. If there's anything, I hope that all of us can be agree upon is that central and western North Dakota was going through a significant drought year in 2017, and this has already been talked about some today and yesterday too. But this is U.S. Drought Monitor from the National Drought Mitigation Center in Lincoln, Nebraska. This is something that is readily available on the internet. This was 2017. There's Coyote Creek Shop Office facility. This is the haul road that they keep talking about. Where are we coming across? This is the north alfalfa field right here. This is from another flyover, same time. Once again, this is June 27th, 2017, and this is the south alfalfa field. This is 1 week away from 4th of July, so this is well into the growing season. You can draw your own conclusions, but things look kind of bleak there, and they were because we're going through a drought. And this is the upland alfalfa field also in the northeast quarter of section 25, and likewise, the stand here is not doing real well. So these guys, I was not on that flyover, and guys came back and said, well, you should probably take a picture of some of those alfalfa fields because really it proves what we've been saying all along is that sub-irrigation is not going on. So this is a close up picture of the north alfalfa field, and this is a distressed hay crop, and this is not due to poor management or mismanagement. It's been my thoughts all along going to Coyote Creek last 5 or 6 years that the Voits are good operators. This is a function of not getting water. It's a function of the drought. If sub-irrigation were ongoing, this field would look as lush as the first round of photographs we looked at from 2014. And I just threw a couple of them. All this stuff here is readily available on the internet. I got a couple of NDSU Extension Service publications, and this particular one right here was put out by Tom Scherer, and I think he's still with NDSU today. But this is May 2007, showing that the average crop rooting depth for alfalfa is 5 feet.
Bruce, could you scroll down just a little bit further?
There's alfalfa on the top right here. Well, I can't read. This is another publication. This was a PowerPoint presentation put out by Joel Ransom, but he actually referenced Lundstrom 1988 also. And it's a little sideways, I can see that, but unrestricted effective rooting depths of selected mature crops, and you can see alfalfa right here. And he puts that at 3.5 to 4 feet, right in that area right there. And this last one, this is another NDSU Extension Service publication. This one was revised in 2019. Trying to get back to the front here. Very touchy. Page 4, if I can. Well, I'm just going to go one page at a time then, I guess. There we go. Okay, we got her. Take a look at the third paragraph down on the left-hand side. Plant roots extract the greatest amount of soil water from the upper part of the root zone, and each crop is different. Generally, for all the crops shown in Figure 1, that's down here on the bottom, more than 90% of the water extracted from the root zone during the growing season will come from the depth shown as shaded. And that depth for alfalfa is 4 feet. So they're saying, and they're consistently saying, that more than 90% of water extracted is from 4 feet and above for alfalfa. I've only got a couple things left here. This was a spreadsheet I put together, and We've talked a lot about two different monitoring wells, CM12 08B, which is located very near Coyote Creek's shop office facility, and CM12 20B, which is further south or upstream, across the road from the Voigt residence. And I'm not going to go through this whole thing, but Don Steffen from Coyote Creek actually, you know, showed a lot of the same information. He presented it in a different manner. He used water level hydrographs, but really this shows it shows water level information that that we recovered from those two alluvial monitoring wells, and what this data show is that since mining began in mid-April 2016, that's up here, water elevation 1891.92, up until the last time that we actually took water level up there was September 24th of 2019. After 3.5 years of coal removal, the water level in 08B has actually risen 0.05 feet, you know, a very small amount, but nonetheless it has come up. But it's fair to say that the water level fluctuates quite a bit, up between 2 and 3 feet. This Coyote Creek Mining Company first put monitoring wells out there in 2012, and we've got data that also goes back to 2012. This basically just shows what happened since coal removal began, because it was asserted that the Coyote Creek Mining Company's coal removal activities either reduced or cut off the flow of water to the alluvial aquifer. And going down to CM 1220B, this is further to the south. This is the alluvial well that is directly across from the south lowland alfalfa fields. Since coal removal began in mid-April 2016, water level here actually came up almost 0.6 feet. This is just, we've developed and maintain a groundwater geodatabase here for all monitoring wells that are thousands of them that are out at the coal mines in North Dakota, dating back to the 1970s for, and a lot of it too is for mines that have been mined and reclaimed for years. And this just provides the data for where I made that spreadsheet and showing that period of record for these groundwater monitoring wells goes back to 2012. Jack, that's all I've got.
So you've heard all the testimony here that was presented today by the Voigts as well as by the company. And some of that was data provided from monitoring wells. Is any of that information that's provided inconsistent with what you have been noticing as you've been doing your well inspections?
The data that the Voigts have brought forward, mostly with through Lance Loken, is very consistent with our data. Groundwater levels in the alluvium average 10 to 12 feet below surface, and that's basically what they have found also.
Sure. And you displayed a couple photographs, and in those photographs, the alfalfa depth showed around between 4 to 6 feet generally, correct, for the rooting depth?
Actually close, yeah, 4 feet, probably about 4 feet, 4 to 5 feet.
Sure. Would you say, though, that roots can go deeper than 4 to 6 feet?
Alfalfa will send a taproot much, much deeper. Some varieties 15, 20 feet, some much more. Okay. But and I think as far as water extraction, I think the NDSU articles kind of show that most of the water that is available for alfalfa is within the top four feet of surface. And the OSM guidelines make reference to that too, saying that 80 or 90% of the alfalfa plant root biomass is within 4 feet of four feet or 4.5 feet of surface. Okay.
In those OSM guidelines, I know it was discussed in the informal conference that alfalfa wasn't necessarily a good indicator of sub-irrigation. Is that correct?
Well, actually, it's alfalfa is a phreatophyte, but OSM guidelines require that alfalfa cannot be used as a gauge when determining the availability or lack of sub-irrigation. It requires a native vegetation be an assessment of native vegetation.
Okay. Just to touch on one other issue, Mr. Beachy, I know you had some discussions at the informal conference, and do you believe that an updated alluvial valley floor determination is necessary?
I do not.
Okay, and why is that?
Well, there's already been two. One was conducted in 2009 by Greg Schmiestad for DWC, mm-hmm. and another was conducted in 2013 by Dr. Dave Bickel, who used to work for the Public Service Commission, and he was one of only two or three people in the country that were hired by OSM to teach identification of alluvial valley floors, and they provided all the evidence that is required, and for those reasons, I just see no reason for another AVF study to be done.
Okay, and you were involved in that previous proceeding where there was you said there was no AVF determination, right?
Yes.
Okay. And you continue to believe there's no AVF determination?
That is correct.
Okay. And I know there were a couple other things that were being discussed related to AVFs, too. I was wondering if you could, explain to the best of your ability the capability of this area to be flood irrigated.
Well,
is that something that was previously addressed as well?
It was, and then it was kind of dropped. We can start with the 2009 AVF report by DWC. Greg Schmiestad talked to Mercer County NRCS, and they said they have no knowledge of any irrigation south of the Knife River in Mercer County. They did know of flood irrigation or sprinkler or flood irrigation ongoing from the Knife River to the east, and from Lake Skokwea and Missouri River to the northeast. So there is no history of flood irrigation here. On that report, the Schmiestad report also crunched the numbers of what's available for surface water availability in Coyote Creek, including water quality, and the numbers just don't work out that flood irrigation is viable in Coyote Creek Valley. The Bickel 2013 AVF report, he did a search of the State Water Commission website regarding water use permits, and there's only a couple in the area. To the north is Ron Gunch. He's about a half mile or so north of the permit area. He's done some irrigating in sections 8 and 17 to the north, and he's drawing his water from the Knife River alluvial aquifer. Drawing water from alluvial aquifer automatically is non-candidate for AVF. And then to the west in section 29, west in section 29. There's another neighbor. And well, I can't find his name, and I don't know if that's important, but he is also have been doing some irrigating from the Knife River aquifer. But no, there's been no water use permits for sections 30 or 31. If irrigation is going to be done, it requires start off with temporary and then conditional and then perfected water use permit from the State Water Commission. There are no water use permits for sections 30 and 31 until October 7th of this year. Mr. Voigt put in an application.
Sure. Now, you showed a number of photos today showing possible irrigation pipes that were previously used in the past. What's your take on that?
Well, I guess one can only speculate. I guess I saw one section of pipe and probably some fittings or components, and I'm going to assume that the previous rancher, Ralph Murray, gave it a shot. And I guess my assessment would be if it had been successful, it would probably still be an ongoing practice. Whether he drew that water out of Coyote Creek or not, I don't know. If he did, that would classify as flood irrigation through AVF. It's possible he did what his other neighbors are doing all around him, and that is trying to use alluvial aquifer water in the alluvial aquifer for irrigation. But beyond that, I can't speculate.
Sure. Thank you. Your Honor, there have been a number of references to a previous case, case RC 13850. I think just for the benefit of the record, since it's been referenced by the commissioners as well as parties, that maybe we move that order into the record.
Is there any objection?
No objection.
Sorry, are you talking about just the order?
Just the order.
From the prior formal
Correct.
Hearing? I guess I would object to just the order without the materials that led up to it. I'd rather incorporate the docket versus just picking something or another from that case.
Sure. Well, I guess as I prefer not to have the whole docket in there, as it relates to AVFs, I'd be happy to sit down and find the docket entries that relate to the AVF and put that all in the record as well.
I do that. The other thing I would suggest is I think the commission can take notice of the order.
Sure. They could do that as well.
I'd be happy to sit down if you'd want to do that too, though.
Sure. You know, I'd be fine if the commission just did want to take notice of what was contained in the order as well. I thought it would be easier to just move into the docket just for the purpose of having it readily available to you. But if you're comfortable with that, commissioners, I'm fine with that as well.
Does it mean to take notice of it?
It's essentially that you took notice of, you're acknowledging that everything that was contained within this order, and I guess you're just taking notice of what is contained in there and that it was actually ordered previously.
Okay. We'll do it that way then, just take notice of the order?
Sure. I'm fine with that too.
Okay.
Mr. Beachy, I think that's all I have for you.
Mr. Broughton, do you have any questions for
Mr.
Beachy?
Thank you. Mr. Beachy, are you aware that the void alfalfa fields were grazed in June of 2017?
Nope.
You referred to some OSM guidance that you've relied on. Do you consider that to be an authoritative source for information on alluvial valley floors?
I do.
Okay. I'd like to ask you about some statements in that guidance and see if you agree with them. One on Roman numeral 2-8
It is also an area, referring to alluvial valley floors, states, it is also an area with water availability sufficient for sub-irrigation or flood irrigation agricultural activities. Do you agree with that?
I do.
And they state in that OSM guidance at Roman numeral 2-9, legislative, judicial, and administrative interpretation of alluvial valley floors indicate that the water availability criteria are met if A, water is available by surface water irrigation, and B, or B, surface water is available in sufficient quantities to support agricultural activities. Do you agree with those statements?
Yes.
And the term flood irrigation means natural flood overflow. Do you agree with that statement?
It can. It also includes enhanced or mechanical flood irrigation, usually with spreader dikes and canals. And
are you familiar with the case study of sub-irrigated alfalfa fields that is in the OSM guidance you referred to?
No.
You've been through this OSM guidance, though, right?
Oh, yes.
And they indicate that the root distribution of an alfalfa plant is important in the plant's ability to tap deep groundwater. Dryland alfalfa plants in Montana will generally root in upper 10 feet of soil and extract the bulk of its water requirements from the upper 13 feet. Although the majority of roots are within the top 4.6 feet of soil, the taproot, which extends deeper, is characteristically covered with small root hairs, which give a large effective surface area for uptake of soil moisture and nutrients. Alfalfa roots have been noted at depths of 65 feet, 66 feet, and 129 feet by Meinzer and 30 feet by Hughes and others. You aware that that's in the OSM guidance that you cited to?
I've read those, yes.
There's another statement. The presence or absence of sub-irrigation was documented by measurement of the soil water content of the profile and observation of diurnal fluctuations at groundwater level or of groundwater level. You agree with that?
Absolutely.
And you indicated that there's fluctuations in the groundwater levels in the void alfalfa fields based on your numbers, right?
That wasn't in reference to diurnal fluctuation, just daily or quarterly, seeing the water levels over, you know, taken quarterly, but not diurnal fluctuation.
So it fluctuates quarterly, but not twice a year?
Not twice a year? No, it's probably fluctuating all the time.
Okay, that's all I have.
All right. Mr. Mann, any questions?
No, Your Honor.
Commissioner Chrisman?
Thank you for the information. I have no more questions on the CPS determination.
All right. Commissioner Crosses?
No questions.
Commissioner Fedorcha?
I'm curious what possible new information could come of a in a new determination. What would we look at that we haven't already looked at?
I think we've got enough information that we don't need another study. I can't imagine.
Because the study would cover all the criteria that has already been covered?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Any redirect, Mr. Hsu?
No, Your Honor, but I guess I would question I just have a general question for the parties. I know there is a suggestion of having another determination. Were you requesting another determination based upon the record of the hearing today, or were you suggesting another determination as in ordering another determination be studied?
I'm sorry, I'm not.
For example, sometimes as a condition of an order, you can say, sure, but this issue needs to be addressed. So are you looking to have another determinant based upon the evidence based on the record today? Are you, as part of that request, were you requesting that the commission pick up to make another determination?
Yeah. So our intent was not to have another hearing on the ABF issue and have another determination made as a result of this hearing process. There was obviously a dispute last time. The PSC has continuing jurisdiction, and like any court of law, if new evidence comes to light, it's something that can be reconsidered. We submitted evidence that wasn't provided to the commission last time about the capability for flood irrigation, the capability for mechanical irrigation, and the other additional information. And so our intent was, we did the soil borings as well, which hadn't been done last time. That's all new evidence, new information. Our intent was simply to provide that information to the commission along with the request that it consider that and make a determination whether that's sufficient for the commission to decide that it wants to look at that issue again.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Are there any other questions for Mr. Beachy? All right, thank you. Mr. Hsu, you have Mr. Mose yet?
Yeah, I'd like to call the Director of Reclamation, Dean Mose, just to provide.
We have about 15 minutes. Do you want to start?
Your Honor, we might be done at 15 minutes.
Okay. That's what I want to hear.
Mr. Mose, I'm going to hold you to that.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mose. You were in the room this morning when I went through the penalties for perjury?
I was.
And you heard those penalties?
Yes.
And do you understand what perjury is?
Yes.
And being advised on the penalties for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this case this afternoon?
I do.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Hsu.
Mr. Mose, will you please state your name for the record?
Dean Mose.
And how long have you been with the PSC?
31 years.
Okay, and in what capacity have you been working at the PSC?
I started as an environmental scientist, primarily with responsibilities for reviewing soils, prime farmland issues, cultural resources. In 2006, I became the assistant director, handling more of some of the administrative inspection and enforcement issues, and then in 2016, the director.
And have you reviewed the application for renewal as well as revision number 9?
Yes.
Okay. And I believe you were prepared to speak to fugitive dust, some capillarity issues with alluvial valley floors, as well as just general reclamation issues.
Correct.
Would you just start off by giving some comments on the fugitive dust issue?
Of course, this issue was raised with the original permit and revision 1 to the permit, and then again in the informal conference related to revision 9, and the Voits raised the issue with regard to what our responsibilities are.
Sure. And how do you view our responsibilities?
Oh, we have some responsibilities here with regard to dust in regards to erosion. Informal conference and the order associated with revision 1, we addressed, I believe, quite well our relation to SMACRA in that regard.
Okay. And has a complaint ever been filed regarding fugitive dust for Coyote Creek Mine?
Pardon?
Has a complaint been filed for dust for Coyote Creek Mine?
Complaint?
Yes.
No, there's not been a complaint. Like I said, Mr. Voit met with us in June, and we asked if he wanted us to treat this as a complaint, and he said no.
Okay. And have you been in contact with the Department of Environmental Quality regarding the air quality issues?
Yes, when we received the request for the informal conference, we met with the Department of Health, or Department of Environmental Quality, and kind of went over what their requirements are, how they saw our responsibility, and just generally what their permits consist of. And
sure. And have they received any complaints regarding?
They indicated they have not.
Okay. Now, there was some discussion about Spring Creek from Mr. Bofto. I think you're generally aware of that monitoring that has been used at that mine?
Correct.
Okay. And do you know what the purpose of that monitoring, why was it implemented? Was it an air quality issue, such as the DEQ would be?
Right.
working
with. You asked the question whether the air monitoring that was done at the Spring Creek mine in Montana, whether that was in relation to their SMACRA permit or the Montana State mining permit, or is it in relation to air quality? And I don't know that that was adequately answered. We have received somewhat of an indication from the off-surface mining today that that is related to monitoring is in conjunction with the EPA and the Montana Air and Waste Management Bureau.
Okay. And is there anything else that you'd like to generally discuss regarding the fugitive dust emission?
Staff on inspections will note if there's dust conditions. I'm sure the mine will testify that the staff will ask, that they've noticed dust and take the appropriate measures, which usually means watering. And So it's noted in inspection reports. Some staff said, well, they make note of it, but they didn't actually put it into the inspection report. I think it's something we'll probably do more diligence on, and in the future.
Sure. Now you also just, are you generally aware of, I guess when you're discussing the DEQ, did they express whether that is a normal practice to use air monitoring devices for coal mines?
The health department?
Yes, DEQ.
DEQ, they are not aware of any other air monitors that are utilized in the state. Prices that they indicated to us were quite a bit higher than what Mr. Bothko had indicated. Several magnitudes higher. They said they are complex. They feel that visual monitoring is as effective as, or probably even more effective than the actual monitors.
And is their staff trained in visual monitoring?
Yes, they are.
Is our staff trained?
No, we're not.
Okay. Now, why don't we just briefly turn to alluvial valley floors? I know there was some discussion of wicking water upwards.
Mm-hmm.
The capillarity. I was wondering if you just could kind of expound upon that a little bit.
Okay. Capillary rise in soils is the wicking up of the water from the groundwater table. I guess the easiest analogy I can make is if you had a puddle of water on the table on the surface, that would be the groundwater surface. If you took a paper towel and dipped the edge into it, that wicking up of the water is the capillary rise. It rises to a certain point. Certain soils are more susceptible to capillary rise than others. Of course, sands and gravels are not very susceptible to capillary rise. Loams tend to be very susceptible to it. Any textural discontinuity in there limits capillary rise. And just because the water rises to a certain level doesn't mean that it's all available. Some of that water is held by the soil particles. It's the free water that the plant extracts. The water in the ground, the lower level in the in that capillary fringe is more readily available. The upper water is not as available. So if I take that paper towel and dip it in there, you could probably squeeze water out of the bottom part. The upper part, it's bound to that paper towel. You can't squeeze the water out of it. It's not free water, and it's the same situation in the soil.
So based upon that, would you think that or would you have knowledge that whether that would have any beneficial use to an alfalfa plant?
If it rises high enough, it certainly has. We're hearing that 90% of the water use is in the upper 4.5 feet. We're not seeing capillary rise to that level. Looking at the photos that Mr. Loken provided yesterday, I just some of them were very close-up photos of the soil profiles of the soil cores. I saw very little plant roots in there. To that tells me that the plants are not extracting water from those depths.
Sure, and you were involved in the previous proceeding as well where the AVF issue was discussed. Was there anything that was presented that would make you change your determination?
No.
Okay. The one last issue that I, unless there's anything else, would you like to add to that too, Mr. Moss?
No.
Okay. Regarding the reclamation issues, is there anything you'd like to, I guess, provide as it relates to that issue?
No, I think Mr. Welch covered it very well. You know, the variances, the invasive species concerns are become much more heightened in the last 10 years. Kentucky bluegrass is and it's not a problem that's unique to reclaimed lands. It's unique to all of North Dakota, really. We're in this cooler, wetter cycle. Kentucky bluegrass is dominated all of our rangeland. So, you know, I think the delay reclamation to kill off as much as they can, to set it back, to give the native grassland plants a competitive edge, it all makes sense.
So is there anything, you have an extensive amount of background with reclamation, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and is there anything that would indicate to you that there are going to be issues going forward with reclamation with Coyote Creek Mine?
The procedures used that are proposed to be used, they're consistent with what's used at other mines. This is a growing, we're gaining information as we're going, and the mining companies are adapting. Most of the mines in North Dakota are putting money into a research project to address issues of compaction and native grass success. Hopefully we're going to, NDSU is doing the study. Coyote Creek is participating, and they're providing financial support as well as physical space to do research. So we're hoping good will come out of that.
Yeah, one last question. I know it was discussed the providing access to Mr. Voigt to the reclamation process. If you made a request to the PSC, would you guys allow him to do a reclamation inspection?
Yes. There's a provision to request inspections, and we if we turn down the request, we have to have a very good reason for it, and I don't see any reason why we would turn it down. So.
Okay. I have no other questions. Thank you.
Mr. Broth, any questions?
Just a couple. Thank you. Mr. Moose, you agree that the mine must effectively control wind erosion and attendant air pollution?
Erosion, certainly, yes.
And that's something that's within the PSC's jurisdiction?
I'm sorry?
That's something that's within the PSC's jurisdiction?
Yes, erosion is certainly part of our responsibility.
And the regulation at 69.5.20905 specifically says the applicant shall specify measures necessary to effectively control wind erosion and attendant air pollution. You agree
Correct.
With that? With respect to the soil bores, you mm-hmm. mentioned that you didn't see plant roots in the cross sections of the soil bores. You understand that's about between 4 to 6 inches, square inches of
Correct.
The entire field?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You saw the pictures in the video of the dust shown by the voids, right?
Correct.
Do you consider that to be effective control of the wind erosion and attendant air pollution?
If it's mining related, it's not effective control.
Okay. No further questions.
Mr. Mann, any questions?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Chrisman?
So the dust control, basically, to the extent it's erosion, is in our jurisdiction, to the extent
that its air quality falls more under DEQ.
Correct. We do not have the authority to set standards or that is, within the air quality permit.
So now talking about monitors that aren't really probably in our jurisdiction anyway, but do your understanding of these air quality monitors, would they distinguish if they were out in the alfalfa fields east of the Coyote Creek between haying going on when it's dusty, traffic on County Road 25, that type of thing, as opposed to dust from the mine?
I really don't know. I doubt it, but that's from a strong point of ignorance. Okay.
The special provision that was in the previous order approving the revision and mm-hmm. and renewal, does that fall totally within our jurisdiction?
Right. The commission has the authority to attach special conditions, or it's called conditions, to the permit, and I think you even made reference to that this morning, and that is in the law.
I know we have the authority to attach conditions,
mm-hmm.
but as I thought about this case and leading up to it, and I think about the particular condition that we attached, and I want to say I understand, you know, with the timing of all that and the fact that the previous mine permit was about to expire, we had to move along really quickly once we got all the documents in.
Correct.
But now in looking at the law, and I'm looking at one part out of a long Century Code 38-14.1-03, and it talks about the PSC exercising general supervision and administration and enforcement of the chapter, but then including the utilization of the powers of other state agencies by delegation to those state agencies to avoid duplication of effort to promote the efficient use of personnel and to assure effective reclamation. So is that provision maybe an example of something that we're potentially overstepping and ought to be left to the DEQ to decide?
Yeah, you know, anything that we require for dust control, I assume would also have to be approved with their air quality permit. We have to coordinate with that. It's we have a, you know, somewhat of a similar situation with the pollutant discharge ND. It's referred to as the NDPDS permit, North Dakota National or Pollutant Discharge Elimination System. That is a Department of Environmental Quality permit. It's the pond discharges. They set the standards. We're out there pretty regularly. We're checking discharges, but really the enforcement, when it comes down to it, unless it's an erosion or sedimentation problem associated with it, we're probably not going to take the enforcement action. That falls to the health department. There is instances where the health department said, go ahead and you take the enforcement action, but for the most part, there's kind of a separation there.
In your long tenure here with the commission, has there been a good relationship between this agency and the DEQ, formerly Health Department, whereby if we noticed a problem in our inspections that falls under their jurisdiction and expertise, just for the efficiency of government, that we don't all have the same experts, that we notify them and they could take care of it, and vice versa, if they seen something that they would notify us?
Correct. It's actually a very good working relationship with the DEQ.
Okay. No other questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Crosius?
Dean, just anecdotally, how often does the staff note dust issues during mine inspections overall? Is that common, or is it on occasion?
I don't know the exact number, but yeah, you know, it occasionally happens where they'll make note of dust on the haul roads, possibly dust from a area that's been stripped, and you know, we'll make note to the or ask the company to take care of the problem.
So from an anecdotally, it's not common, but it does occur.
It does occur, right? You know, when you're out there and it's muddy conditions, you don't have dust problems. When you're out and it's dry conditions, as Mr. Stephan testified this morning, the winter is more problematic. can't be watering, or they're not watering as much because of freezing conditions, safety concerns, it's not like every inspection is noting dust problems. It does happen, though.
Going to the weeds on the 20, I think it was the 20-acre or 22-acre parcel, 22-acre parcel, if I remember mm-hmm. right. I think the other was like 7.8.
Right.
And that was 5, but going back to 4.
Mm-hmm.
One of the answers was that in 2019, wet conditions prohibited or inhibited, might be a better word, normal practices for reseeding herbicide application. Would you agree that it was too challenging in 2019?
Well, 2019 was certainly a challenging year, especially the later half of the year, I believe. You know, the second half of the growing season, August, September, early October, with rain and stuff. It was a challenging year.
Is that when you would expect the oat crop to be? Well, I shouldn't really necessarily call it a crop, but the oats to be have been seeded.
I can't testify as to when it would have been ready for seeding or I'm not aware when it was respread when why it wasn't seeded in the spring.
What's the measurement when inspectors are out to say, okay, it was just we understand, or that might not be the best way of putting it, but how do they take conditions like that into consideration? How does that work into the inspection process? Just visual inspection, or
there's always extenuating circumstances. I'm not sure what the question what your question is.
Just how is there a benchmark in place? Or is it on a case-by-case basis?
It's a lot case-by-case. I mean, as Mr. Welch testified, there's these windows for seeding, and they're guidelines. It's not cast in stone that you have to seed, from May 15th to June 30th. It's a window of opportunity, but some years it may not be. Other years it may be the ideal time.
All right. No other questions. Thank you.
I know, Commissioner Chrisman, you need to leave, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. You can go. I can listen to the recording.
Let me ask this. Are you going to have any rebuttal? So we just have questions for Mr. Mose yet. So is that okay with you if we just finish his question?
It is, if it's okay with the parties, and I will commit to listening to the recording.
Thank you. That's fine.
Okay. All right. Then we will... continue.
Thank you, and thanks, everyone.
Go ahead, Commissioner Fedorchak.
Okay, I don't think I have too many, but based on what Mr. Welch said and what you've said, the dust issue, it maybe isn't what the inspectors have seen while we've been out there. Everyone seems to agree that that's not... acceptable to what's envisioned in the permit.
Right. We were surprised by it, that mm-hmm. it was not seeded. As was testified, there was no erosion. Therefore, we just felt there was no sense for an enforcement action. It's a management issue.
So the dust in those cases came from, in your opinion, the stockpiles?
Pardon?
Where the dust in the winter pitchers that covered the snow
mm-hmm.
is what I'm referencing. What did you say was the remedy for that seeding?
Well, I'm sorry. Maybe I misunderstood.
Okay. So I'm sorry, I probably wasn't very clear, so we'll back up. Mr. Broughton, what? Oh, it's
the,
yeah, it's
the
probably
the
number
dust
two.
On the snow pictures.
Yeah, is it void two? Void
nine, I think.
Oh, I knew it was early on. Void nine, yeah. So in void nine, the dust and the snow picture.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not probably in compliance with the permit, this level of dust.
I don't know.
So, yeah, because there, I'm sure there's some spectrum for if this was an unusual mm-hmm. occurrence
right.
or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what if, say, the inspectors are out there, saw this, what's the remedy for this in the permitting, in our oversight process? What's
well,
the remedy for this?
If it's occurring at the time when the inspectors are out there to take appropriate measures, for the company to take appropriate measures, whether it's stopping operations, watering, taking emergency measures such as ridging soil, that's been done at mines on inspectors' concerns.
Mm-hmm. So do you intend to work with the company on addressing this moving forward? I mean, they've outlined a number of practices that they've implemented to mitigate this, because they, Mr. Stefan, also didn't seem to be comfortable with this level of dust.
Well, I mean, you try to minimize the dust as much as possible, and to say that you're going to eliminate it, that's going to be tough. You minimize it to the extent possible. Being proactive instead of reactive. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, to the extent possible, weather conditions change fast, be adaptable.
So how do you propose, from a oversight standpoint, dealing with this moving forward?
I think, you know, clear, the company, like I said, we visited with the health department and we asked them, are the measures that they've specified in the permit, are they typical of what you would expect for a surface coal mine in North Dakota? And they said they are. And I guess just to make sure that they're implemented, and again, that they're being proactive with regard to the daily operations and adapting.
Okay. And so will you be on the inspections making note? I think somebody mentioned that they're going to add these to the notes.
I said, some of the inspectors made note on a regular basis of, you know, what the dust conditions were during the inspection, what measures were being taken. Others, if it wasn't an issue, didn't make note of it. And even if it was an issue, they may not have made a note of it in the inspection report. So, you know, we're there on an average, you know, once every week or two. So, you know, we're there. We're not there all the time.
Right. And then if I'm looking at specifically our jurisdiction as it relates to dust, would the dust created by the roads, that doesn't suggest any sort of erosion. So that seems to me not something that would be under our jurisdiction.
I guess I would agree.
So it's more the dust that might come off of the stockpiles?
Stockpiles, you know, disturbance areas that have been stripped, topsoil, subsoil, stockpiles, reclaim areas that aren't mulched or vegetated yet.
Okay. Okay. So that's that. How much time, Dean, have you guys spent on these issues in specifically relating to this set of issues?
The renewal itself and revision, you mean, or
no? The the informal, the formal, and everything leading up to it?
Well, it's involved a number of staff for, you know, several weeks.
Okay.
Not you know, all of our time during that, but, you know, several days a week for several weeks.
And obviously this is something that you guys have dealt with before on other mines when there's an issue with landowners.
We try to be responsive to the landowners
Okay. Do you have a comfort level that this is going to, that there can be some remedies put in place so that this isn't a standard way of dealing with this stuff on this mine? Because I have concerns that we have, you know, enough staff to handle it.
Mm-hmm. I guess I would be hopeful that we would reach that level.
Okay. Well, I'll be looking for suggestions for some creative ways or maybe some different ways to work with these parties so that it can be more productive than just fighting it out through the, you know, legal process moving forward, because I think that just, it's not timely, it's expensive, and it's, I don't think ends up with a great result. So, okay, nothing more for me. Thank you.
Mr. Hsu, any redirect?
Just your one question, Your Honor. Now, Commissioner Fedorchak was asking you how to ensure that the company is being proactive in implementing their fugitive dust minimization plan, is what I'll call it. Was that part of the goal of that special condition that staff requested?
It is, yeah. The special condition was attached. So when we do get a complaint, we can go and say what the conditions were that day, what was being done as part of our response to addressing that complaint.
Right, and if you are able then to, if you know, find that there is a systematic problem, then you'll know what measures are working and what aren't working then,
right,
based upon that.
With time we'll get a sense of that.
Sure, thank you.
All right, are there any other questions, Mr. Broughton?
Just a couple. You were asked a little bit about roads, and I just want to confirm one thing with you. Under 69.5.2.2401, it states that each road must be located, designed, constructed, reconstructed, used, maintained, and reclaimed so as to control or prevent erosion. So you agree that that's part of the PSC's jurisdiction to control that, right?
Control erosion, correct.
Okay. You talked about some conversations with the DEQ related to the control of dust. Would you agree that the measures in a plan aren't helpful if they're not implemented effectively?
Well, implementation is a big part of any plan.
Okay. That's all I have.
All right. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Morales.
Thank you.
Mr. Hsu, anything further?
Nothing, Your Honor, just a couple things we have to wrap up probably after closing.
Sure. Anything from the other parties?
No. Maybe I'm jumping the gun here, but with respect to closings, I was going to ask if we could do them written.
Yep, we'll talk about that. Yeah. Mr. Mann, did you have anything further as far as testimony or?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Okay. So, first thing on my list is Mr. Broughton, the replacement photographs with the date stamps. Do you have an estimate of how long it's going to take you to get those filed?
I think if we could have till Monday, we could get that together and filed.
Is that okay? So, let's see, that would be the 23rd? Yeah, December 23rd. Okay, so we'll set a deadline for that, for the 23rd. Okay, and Mr. Broughton, you wanted to do written closing arguments?
Just in the interest of getting folks out of here, and I think that's probably more helpful for everyone as well.
Okay. Are you okay with that, Mr. Mann?
I guess, yeah, in light of the fact that, you know, we already need to address a response to the brief on jurisdiction that was submitted today, I suppose it makes sense. We can do written closings in conjunction with that.
Can we do a simultaneous filing date?
I think that's appropriate.
Okay. I guess I'm going to ask this first. The record won't officially close till we get the closing arguments, Mr. Hsu? Because I know we have a 30-day deadline to issue an order, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
But that won't kick in till the closing arguments are filed?
Closing arguments and the remaining exhibits.
Okay. So how long would you guys like to file closing arguments?
I don't know if anyone has a preference. My preference would be to push it into that week of the 6th through the 10th of January, just so we're not all having to do it over the holidays.
That sounds good. I don't have an objection with that.
Your Honor, it's not that I have an issue with that, but the staff has a really short window. Actually, the commission has a very short window in order to actually issue an order. There's no possibility for extension written in the law for an order on 30 days. So along with receiving proposed findings and scheduling, and probably having a work session to discuss it, we might need a little more time than that.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Do you want the same date for closing arguments and proposed findings, or do you want two separate dates?
I think probably the same date would be preferable.
That's okay with the parties?
Yeah. Are you saying push the date for both of those back a little bit?
Actually bring them closer. I'm sorry. So maybe like January 5th is what I was saying. So this is my estimation, sorry, just from pulling the calendar, that we'd have to have our order actually issued by January 16th, which means, I mean, we need a certain amount of time to be able to, for the commissioners to meet and discuss even what you guys provide.
So I thought that what Judge Hogan was saying is that if we have the record, the 30 days doesn't start until the closings come in.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Ah. Yeah, well, that would help. I'm sorry, I misunderstood that.
It would be my understanding the record wouldn't officially close and your 30 days wouldn't kick in until your closing arguments are filed.
Sure. I guess I'd be comfortable if we're going to interpret it in that manner. I know it says the hearing itself, but if we're going to consider the hearing as the record remaining open.
And just so I'm clear, we operate, is this pursuant to Chapter 2832, or is there something specific?
This is something specifically in our it's Title 38,
okay.
3814.1.
Do you have that?
I do have it available.
In front of you? Let's make sure that we get the timeline right.
It's 3814.1-30 sub 3G1.
Do you want to read it? I don't know.
Sure. Whenever a formal hearing has been held, the commission shall issue a written order pursuant to Chapter 2832, providing the decision must be issued within 30 days after the hearing. The commission shall have no discretion to increase such time period. It's very,
They were anticipating.
So is there any wiggle room there, Jack?
We thought about this.
It's heavily important.
I don't know how we did it in that first one, because that was right. Delayed. But I think we had the court recorder had to get that. Because that was, we didn't have an order until April. January when we finished.
I think what Alana at the time had said is that her view was that if all the parties stipulated, they could do it.
Sure.
I think
there's a new sheriff in town.
I think the 6th is doable.
Sure.
That helps.
I mean,
that's a Sunday, so.
Sure. I would assume that there would be no room for a stipulation if it says there's absolutely zero discretion to extend the 30-day time.
Jack, let me ask this question. So this is a 2-day hearing based on, if it was a hard and fast rule on the 30 days, and it's very clearly written,
sure.
Is it on the first, from the first day of the hearing, from the second day of the hearing, or if we're in effect extending the hearing because of allowing time for closing arguments.
Sure, I would assume it from be from the close of the hearing.
That would be my assumption as well.
So I guess if the parties are willing to interpret that as the hearing is remaining open while the record is open, I'd be comfortable with that if we're in agreement on that.
So everyone?
Yeah, I mean, the statute says 30 days after the hearing, and I think I would agree with
the hearing
everyone
record.
and the ALJ that a hearing will be closed after final submissions of all the exhibits and the closing arguments.
Sure.
Well, I think there's a distinction between keeping the record open and the hearing, but since we're doing closing arguments, in my mind, that's part of the hearing.
Right.
That's
yeah.
not part of the record. So I think if we set a deadline for written closing arguments, I think it's reasonable
that's
to interpret that as the close of the hearing.
Sure.
If well, you're comfortable with that, or the parties are comfortable with that.
With that in mind, in the agreement of the parties, I'm fine with that.
Okay. And both the parties are, we'll get you on record, Mr. Broughton. Are you
okay
with that?
I agree with it, and I'm okay with that.
And Mr. Mann?
Your Honor, I agree as well.
Okay. So, that aside, let's look at calendars again. So, if we have, so we'll set one date then for written closing arguments and proposed findings. So, the question is how long the parties need to get those submitted.
I'm just throwing it out there. My request would be the 10th of January. It's the end of that first full week of January after the holidays.
Does that work for you, Mr. Mann?
That's okay. Just so I'm clear, that's for written closing arguments and proposed findings?
Correct.
Or they'll both be filed together?
Yes.
And simultaneously by all parties?
Yes.
Yeah, that's fine.
Mr. Hsu, are you okay with that deadline?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So, the replacement photos will be filed by next Monday, which is December 23rd. And then, just so we're clear for a record, written closing arguments and written proposed findings will be filed by all parties simultaneously, with the deadline being January 10th, 2020.
And, Your Honor, the written closing arguments, I'm assuming that includes the brief that I'd mentioned in response to Mr. Broughton's brief on the jurisdictional
issue. Right, are you
going to
do two separate ones, or are you going to lump it into your closing argument?
Yeah. I can include it with a closing argument, just make it, I think it's cleaner if I just do it all together.
Okay. Are you good?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Any other issues we need to discuss?
Not from us, Your Honor.
One issue I guess I would be curious as to whether the voice will be responding, providing a response to the motion for attorney's fees as well?
Yes.
Okay. And is there a time period for that as well?
The person who knows is gone. I can't remember how we interpreted it. I think my assumption was it'd be a 21-day. It's not a Rule 3.2 motion, but
sure.
I'm assuming that. Wade, do you remember the date that was filed?
December 5th.
December 5th?
The date that it was.
Okay.
Longer.
And one more thing, Your Honor, just on the January 10th date, close of business, could we, like 5 p.m., is that the deadline then?
Yeah,
or?
Close okay. of business.
5 p.m.?
5 p.m.,
okay.
So just so, well, I don't think there is technically a rule on response time on the motion. Could we make it the 30th? Wade, would you be okay with that?
What are we talking about now, the attorney's
fees?
I didn't look at the rule. For response time, you're talking about December 30th response?
Yeah.
That's fine.
All right.
That's all I had, Your Honor.
Okay. Anything else? Other deadlines or issues we need to discuss?
No? Not for me, Your Honor.
Mr. Mann?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Then I'll note for the record, it is 4:37. And since we have written closing arguments, I guess I will say that we're recessing in this matter.
Okay.